This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump by Assad Haider. Whether class or race is the more important factor in modern politics is a question right at the heart of recent history's most contentious debates. Among groups who should readily find common ground, there is little agreement. To escape this deadlock, Assad Haider turns to the rich legacies of the Black freedom struggle. Drawing on the words and deeds of Black revolutionary theorists, he argues that identity politics, as we have come to know it, is not synonymous with anti-racism, but instead amounts to the neutralization of its movements. It marks retreat from the crucial passage of identity to solidarity, and from individual recognition to the collective struggle against an oppressive social structure. Weaving together autobiographical reflection, historical analysis, and theoretical exegesis, Mistaken Identity is a passionate call for a new practice of politics beyond colorblind chauvinism and the ideology of race. And to make this add into a bit of an advertorial, I'd like to point out that I just finished the book. It's really stellar, and I'll be interviewing Assad shortly. Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump by Assad Haider. Out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Americans are profoundly unwell. Suicide rates have skyrocketed, as, of course, have overdose deaths. Sure, there's an outpouring of public sympathy after a beloved celebrity like Anthony Bourdain ends his life. But the very language we use to talk about mental health and drug addiction is stigmatizing precisely because it is individualizing. The conventional wisdom is that these are people with problems. But what if it's the capitalist system that's entirely insane? The insanity of that system is the topic of David Harvey's latest book, Marx, Capital, and the Madness of Economic Reason, from Oxford University Press. The book is a primer on capital, all three volumes, mind you, from a scholar who has taught these pivotal socialist texts to millions, in person and online. Before we get rolling, I want to point out that you'll notice that David sounds like he's sitting in a studio with me. That's because we're spending the donations that you've made at patreon.com on improving the audio quality of the show. We paid a radio engineer to do what's called a tape sync. What that means is that while I was in my studio in Providence, David was in New York, and the engineer was sitting there with him, recording with a mic. The result is that it sounds entirely better than Skype or a phone line. We want to do tape syncs with more shows, but it costs money. So please make a donation at patreon.com/thedig so we can spend your money on making this show more pleasant to listen to. That's patreon.com/thedig. Oh, and one last thing on that topic of stigmatizing people with mental or behavioral health issues. The governor of my state, Rhode Island, has indicated that she will sign a horrible piece of legislation that will make it easier for prosecutors to charge purported drug dealers with homicide in cases where someone fatally overdoses. The overdose crisis is hitting Rhode Island really hard, but the bill that Governor Gina Raimondo, a Democrat, is looking to sign will only destroy more lives and quite possibly lead to more deaths. This is law and order political theater, and it's playing with the lives of the most vulnerable people in my state. And so I'm sharing a call to action from the harm reduction group, Protect Families First. Please call Governor Raimondo and tell her that more incarceration can't be the solution to the opioid crisis, and to please veto Kristen's Law. You can call Governor Raimondo at 401-222-2080. That's 401-222-2080. Okay, without further delay, here's David Harvey, a professor of anthropology at the City University of New York Graduate School and the author of many books, including The Enigma of Capital and a brief history of neoliberalism. David Harvey, welcome to The Dig.
Well, thank you.
You've been teaching Capital for quite a long time, and I'd like to set the table for this interview by asking you to lay out a brief overview of what each of the three lengthy volumes is about so that listeners have a guide to the rest of our discussion.
Well, this is one of the things I've been concerned with in trying to teach Marx, because there's a wood for the trees problem. Marx is very much into detail, and it's sometimes hard to get a sense of exactly what the whole conception of capital is about, and that's what I'm trying to communicate these days. And really, it's simply that the capitalist starts the day with a certain amount of money, takes the money into the marketplace and buys some commodities like means of production and labor power, and puts them to work in a labor process that produces a new commodity, and then that new commodity is sold for money plus a profit. Then the profit is redistributed in various ways in the form of rents and interest and all this kind of stuff, and then it circulates back into that money, which starts the production cycle again. So it's a circulation process that goes on. And the three volumes of Capital deal with different aspects of that circulation process. The first volume deals with the process of production. The second volume is really dealing with circulation and what we call realization, that is the way in which the commodity becomes converted back into money. And the third volume deals with distribution, which is how much of it goes to the landlord, how much of it goes to the financier, how much of it goes to the merchant and the like, before it is all turned around and sent back into the circulation process. So the three volumes of Capital occupy different parts of this circulation process. And that's what I try to teach, so that people understand the relationships between the three volumes of Capital and don't get lost entirely in volume one or volume two or volume three or even parts of those volumes.
That leads me into my next question, which is that you differ with other Marx scholars in certain ways, and I'm nowhere near enough of a Marxologist to have a good handle on all of the debates. But one major difference, if I have it right, is that you pay a lot of attention to volumes two and three of Capital in addition to volume one, while a lot of Marx scholars mostly find volume one exclusively to be of interest. Tell me about why you argue that all three volumes are important and where you part with other scholars.
Well, I think they're important because this is what Marx says. I mean, in volume one, he kind of says, he says basically, in volume one, I deal with this, in volume two, I deal with that, and in volume three, I deal with something else. And he says that many times. And it's clear that in Marx's mind, he had an idea of the totality of the circulation of capital, and that his plan was to sort of break it down into these three component parts in the three volumes. So I'm just following what Marx says he's doing. Now, the problem, of course, is that volumes two and three were never completed. And so we're dealing with manuscripts and things, and it's not as satisfactory as volume one. And the other problem is that volume one, in many ways, is, I think, a literary masterpiece. It's full of all kinds of wonderful literary allusions and the like, whereas volumes two and three are more technical and harder to follow. So I can understand why, if people want to read Marx with a certain sense of joy and fun, that they would stick with volume one. But I'm kind of going and saying, well, no, look, if you really want to understand what his conception of capital is, then you can't understand it just as being about production. It's about circulation, and it's about getting it to market and selling it, and then it's about distributing the profits in various ways. So I'm just following what Marx said he was doing.
In terms of volume three, it's important. One reason that it's important, if I read you correctly, is that we needed to understand this dynamic of constant expansion that drives capitalism, what you call a bad infinity citing this really excellent phrase from Hegel. Well, explain what this bad infinity is.
Well, actually, you get this bad infinity in volume one, which is that the system has to expand because it's all always about profit. It's always about creating what Marx called a surplus value. And the surplus value then gets reinvested in creation of more surplus value. So capital is about constant expansion. And what that does is to say, if you grow at 3% a year forever, then we get to the point where the amount of expansion required is absolutely huge. In Marx's time, there's plenty of space in the world to expand into, whereas right now we're talking about 3% compounding rate of growth on everything that's happening in China and South Asia and Latin America, and the problem arises, where are you going to expand into? And that's the bad infinity coming into being. And in volume three of Capital, Marx talks about, well, maybe the way only way it can expand is by monetary expansion, because with money, there's no limit. I mean, if we're talking about commodities and using cement or something like that, there's a sort of physical limit. Whereas with money, you could just add zeros to the global money supply. And if you look at what we did after 2007, 2008, we added zeros to the money supply by something called quantitative easing. And that money then just flowed back into stock markets and then asset bubbles and property markets. And one of the strange things was, after the crisis in property markets in 2007, 2008, we've now got a situation where in every metropolitan area of the world that I've visited, there's a huge boom in construction, there's a huge boom in property asset prices, all of which is being fueled by the fact that money's being created and it doesn't know where to go except into a speculation in asset values.
You're trained as a geographer, and for you, Marx's account of capitalism is fundamentally about dealing with problems of space and time. And money and credit are ways that these problems are solved. Explain why these two axes of space and time are so critical.
Well, for instance, the interest rate is about discounting into the future. And borrowing is about foreclosing upon the future. So that credit and debt is a claim upon future production. Which means that the future is foreclosed upon because we've got to pay our debts. Ask any student who's heavily in debt, to the tune of, I said, $200,000. Well, their future is foreclosed because they've got to pay off $200,000 of their indebtedness. And so the foreclosure of the future is something that is, I think, a terribly important aspect of what capital is about. Now, the space stuff comes in because as you start to expand, then there's always the possibility, if you can't expand in this space, you take your capital and you go into another space. For instance, Britain was producing a lot of surplus capital in the 19th century, and so a lot of it was flowing to North America, some of it was flowing to Latin America, some of it was flowing to South Africa, places like that. So there's a geographical aspect to this, that the expansion of the system is about getting what I call spatial fixes, that you've got a problem, you've got excess capital, what are you going to do with it? Well, you have a spatial fix, which means you go out and you build something somewhere else in the world. And if you have an unsettled continent like North America in the 19th century, then, of course, there's vast amounts of place you can expand into. But now North America has been pretty much covered. Now everybody's moved into China, and China's kind of pretty much covered now. So the problem is the kind of the spatial reorganization is not simply about expansion, it's also about reconstruction. So we get deindustrialization in the United States and Europe, and then the kind of reconfiguration of urban areas through urban redevelopment, so that cotton mills in Massachusetts get turned into condominiums, those kinds of transformations. So the geography of it is, for me, very, very important to look at, but we're running out of both space and time right now, and that's one of the big problems of contemporary capitalism.
And in terms of the recent economic crisis in the U.S. in terms of the aspects, the space and time axes, you talk about the future being foreclosed upon, and that term is very much applicable when it comes to debt on homes when they can't be repaid. Homes are literally foreclosed upon.
Yeah, that's why I kind of think the term foreclosure is very interesting. I mean, it forecloses in that sense. People lose their house. So they, you know, what was it? I don't know, 7 million people lost their houses in the crash back in 2007, 2008. So their future was foreclosed upon. But at the same time, the debt economy has not gone away. You would have thought that after 2007, 2008, there would have been a pause in debt creation. But actually what you see is a huge increase in debt creation. So it seems like contemporary capitalism is increasingly loading down more and more with debt. And that is something which I think should concern all of us, because how is that debt going to be repaid? And by what means? And are we going to end up with more and more money creation, which then has nowhere to go except in terms of speculating in asset values, which can be everything from Picasso's to property. And then we start actually building things for people to invest in, not for people to live in. I mean, this is, again, one of the most amazing things about contemporary China, that you'll see whole cities that have been built and have not yet lived in, yet people have bought into them because this is a good investment of way to invest in the future.
It's precisely that issue of credit, if I read you right, that led you to borrow this phrase from Derrida, this notion of the madness of economic reason. And for me, it's a really interesting use of this idea of madness, because colloquially, madness and insanity are invoked to stigmatize or pathologize individuals with mental illness in a way that I think often works to legitimate the status quo. When what Marx shows us and what your book shows us is that it is in fact the system that is insane.
Yeah, and I think the best measure of that is to look at what happens in a crisis. You know, capital produces crises periodically. And one of the characteristics of a crisis is that you have surpluses of labor, unemployed, not knowing how to make a living, at the same time as you have surpluses of capital that don't seem to be able to find any place to go to get an adequate rate of return. So you have these two surpluses sitting side by side in a situation where social need is chronic, where we actually need to put capital and labor together to actually create things. But you can't do that because what you want to create is not profitable. And if it's not profitable, then capital doesn't do it. It sort of goes on strike. And so we end up with surplus capital and surplus labor side by side. And that seems to me to be the height of irrationality. And yet we're taught that the capitalist economic system is highly rational, but it's not. It actually produces these incredible irrationalities.
Before we get any further, I want to ask you to situate Marx a bit in his historical context. You recently had a debate in the electronic pages of Jacobin with William Clare Roberts, the author of Marx's Inferno, which reads Volume 1 of Capital as modeling the structure of Dante's Inferno. And I don't want to get too much into that debate, but instead ask you about something that you agree with Roberts on, which is how to situate Marx in this historical context of his socialist contemporaries. And you write that Marx broke with moralist socialists like Proudhon, Fourier, Saint-Simon, and Robert Owen. Who were these socialists? And why and how did Marx part from them?
In the early stages of capitalist development, particularly in the industrial form, there were obvious problems of conditions of labor in the mines and in the factories and all the rest of it. So that reasonable people, and that would include professionals and the bourgeois population and so on, started to look at this with a certain amount of horror. That horror was registered, for instance, by the Romantic poets, kind of saying, you know, this is horrendous what's going on in terms of industrialization. And so one of the things that came out of this was a sort of moral repugnance against industrialism. And many of the early socialists were moralists in the good sense of that term, and expressed their outrage and basically said, look, we could construct an alternative kind of society, one which is based on communal well-being, one which is based on social solidarities and issues of that kind. But Marx looked at the situation and said, well, actually, the problem with capital is not that. The problem with capital is that it's almost like it's amoral. It doesn't have a morality, and that to try to confront it with moral reason is never going to get very far, because the system, as it were, is self-generating and self-reproducing, and we've got to deal with that self-reproduction of the system. So Marx took a kind of what he considered to be a much more scientific view of what capital was about. And then tried to sort of say, so now we need to actually replace the whole system. So it's not a matter of cleaning up the factories and that kind of thing. We've got to deal with the way in which capital, in its process, does engage in this mad process that Marx describes so effectively.
I'm not sure if you've seen it yet, but if you have, how do you think the film Young Karl Marx? Is it an accurate representation?
I've seen the film and the play, you know, and of course Marx was a character of his time, and I think it's interesting to look at him from that perspective. But the thing that I want to do is to say, look, Marx actually had a theory of capital, and capital is still with us. We're still in a society which is driven by capital accumulation. And what Marx did was to abstract from the particularities of his time and to talk about the dynamics of capital accumulation and to point out its contradictory character, to point out how it actually, in its driving force, is actually imprisoning all of us in the debt. For example, you know, we like to think we have freedom of choice. But right now, the indebtedness in the United States, or the indebtedness in the global economy, is so huge that we don't have any freedom of choice. We've actually foreclosed upon that by actually paying for last year's sins with this year's debts, and that's our problem. So what Marx did, it seems to me, was to sort of say, well, this is beyond simply moral protest. This is about talking about a systematic process which we need to grapple with and understand its dynamics, because otherwise what we find is that people come along and they try to create some sort of moral reform, and the moral reform that's gets co-opted by capital. And it's really fantastic, actually, over the last few years. We see something like the internet, which everybody thought of initially as a great liberatory technology and a great liberatory force that would allow for a great deal of human freedom. And now look what's happened to it. It's actually sort of dominated by a few monopoly that do all kinds of things, like collect our data and then give it to all kinds of seedy characters who start using it for political purposes. So something that started out as a real liberatory kind of technology suddenly turns into a vehicle of repression and oppression. And then if you ask the question, how did that happen? You either say, well, it's because some evil people out there who did it, or with Marx, you say, well, that's the systematic character of capital, always to do that. So there's no such thing as a good moral idea that capital can't co-opt and turn into something that's horrendous. That is almost every utopian schema that's come across the horizon over the last, you know, 50, 100 years has been turned into a dystopia. By the capitalist dynamic. And that's what Marx is pointing to and say, look, you've got to grapple with that process. And if you don't grapple with that process, you're not going to actually get anywhere in terms of creating an alternative world which is really emancipatory and is about the delivery of human freedom to everybody.
I'd like to ask you more about that contradictory process. Marx was, of course, obviously a fierce critic of capitalism, but he was also an admirer of its powers of creative destruction. He thought, for example, that capitalism was a great improvement in many ways upon feudalism. I wonder How do you think we should think of these destructive powers today? So much of what capitalism destroys is quite obvious to my listeners, whether we're talking about the environment or entire communities throughout the American Rust Belt, where the opioid crisis is rushing in to fill a void that was once filled by unionized manufacturing jobs. But on the other hand, how do we need to take account of rising incomes in places like China and India and this massive process of infrastructure construction that's going on in countries like those? How do you approach these contradictory processes?
I think one of the things that Marx, you're right to mention this, because Marx is not just simply a critic of capitalism. He's also, I think, a fan of some of the things that capitalism builds. And that's, if you like, the biggest contradiction of all for Marx is the fact that what capital has done is to build the capacity technologically and organizationally to actually create a far, far better world. But it does it through social relations, which are about relations of domination rather than of emancipation. And that is, the huge central contradiction. And Marx keeps saying, why don't we use all of this technological and organizational capacity to create a world which is liberatory and emancipatory rather than one which is about domination. Now, of course, one of the things that happens is that certain people benefit greatly from capital accumulation. Some people get very, very rich. But for every person who gets very, very rich, there are a dozen people who get poorer and poorer and poorer. And that is, again, the sort of central dilemma that Marx is really having to confront. And we have to confront, too.
A related contradiction is, how should Marxists think about the current debate over globalization in the U.S., which has gotten more muddled and confusing, I think, than at least ever before in my lifetime? On the left, there seems to be very little support for the tariffs that Trump has put in place. But how do you think the left should look at this current debate and Trump's protectionism in a way that differs from the mainstream economist finger wagging?
I think the left, Marx actually approved of globalization. In the Communist Manifesto, there's a wonderful passage that talks about it and sees it as potentially liberatory and emancipatory in its possibilities. But again, the question is, why is it that these emancipatory possibilities are not taken up, and why is it that they're used as means of domination of one class by another class? Yes, it's true that some people in the world have improved their incomes, but the last Oxfam report, as I recall, said eight families have enough wealth to equivalent of about 50% of the world's population. So the increasing inequalities are very much in evidence. And those increasing inequalities are not just simply about people having individual wealth and power. They have a great deal of social wealth and power, so that we look at some of the characters who are controlling political processes. We look at the media, the way the media is dominated by monopoly power. We look at monopoly power on the internet. We're looking at monopoly power all over the place. And again, Marx is kind of saying we have to do something about that that failure. But in doing so, we don't get nostalgic and say we all want to go back to feudalism, or we all want to go live on the land or something of that kind. We've got to think about a progressive future, which is utilizing all of the technologies we have available, but for utilizing them for a social purpose rather than utilizing them for a purpose of individual wealth and power increasing in fewer and fewer hands.
Which is the very same sort of reason that Marx broke with his romantic socialist contemporaries. In terms of what liberal economic theories, what mainstream economists miss about all of this, you cite a really great passage from Marx. Every reason which they being the economists, put forward against crisis is an exercised contradiction, and therefore a real contradiction, which can cause crises. The desire to convince oneself of the non-existence of contradictions is, at the same time, the expression of a pious wish that the contradictions, which are really present, should not exist. What is it that mainstream economics sets out to do, and what do they elide or hide in the process?
They hate contradictions. I mean, you know, it doesn't fit with their worldview. The economists love to confront what they call problems, and problems have solutions. Contradictions don't. They exist with you all the time, and that therefore you have to manage them, and they get out of hand. They get heightened into what Marx called absolute contradictions. I mean, how do economists deal with the fact that in the crisis of the 1930s or the 1970s or more recently, surplus capital and surplus labor sit side by side and nobody seems to have a clue as to how to put them back together so that they can work for socially productive purposes? I mean, how do economists explain a situation arising of that sort? Well, Keynes tried in his way to do something which came a little bit close to some of the things that Marx sets up, but by and large, economists have no idea how to deal with contradictions of this sort. Whereas Marx is kind of saying that it's in the nature of capital accumulation that it internalizes this contradiction, and this contradiction then produces these crises periodically, which are very difficult to live through and which actually claim lives and create misery of the sort you've mentioned already through the deindustrialization of the American Midwest or, the deindustrialization that's occurred in Britain. So those sorts of phenomena have to be sort of addressed, and economics doesn't really have a very good way of thinking about them because they're into something which might be called an efficient market hypothesis, for example, in which the market is supposed to work in such a way as to give you rational outcomes when plainly it doesn't.
In terms of that contradiction which we've been discussing, which you describe in your book as surplus capital and surplus labor existing side by side with seemingly no way to put them back together. After the recent crisis, how were those two things, surplus capital and surplus labor, reacquainted? And is the way that they've been rejoined, has it resulted in a new form of capitalism distinct from that which prevailed before the crisis? In other words, are we still living under neoliberalism, or has something new taken root?
I think the response to the crisis of 2007-2008 was to, in most of the world, not in China, and I accept China out of this, but most of the world doubled down into a neoliberal austerity kind of politics, which made things worse, in my view, rather than making some sort of partial solution possible. So that actually since then, of course, we've had several kinds of cuts at trying to get out of the crisis. It hasn't worked very well. I mean, slowly, unemployment has come down in the United States, but of course it's gone shooting up in Brazil and Argentina and places like that. So,
and wages are lagging. Wage growth is pretty slow.
Yeah, wages haven't gone anywhere. Then you look at what the Trump administration has just been doing. First off, it's followed some very, very neoliberal policies. I mean, the budget that they passed back in last December is a pure neoliberal document. It basically benefits the bondholders and the capital owners, and everybody else is sort of pushed to one side. So this is a kind of pure neoliberal thing. And the other thing that's happened is that deregulation, which is, of course, one of the big things that neoliberals like, the Trump administration has doubled down on deregulation of the environment and labor laws and everything else, so that actually there's been, as it were, a doubling down on the neoliberal solutions. The problem being that the neoliberal argument, which had a lot of legitimacy, say, in the 1980s and 1990s as being liberatory in some way, nobody believes that anymore. Everybody realizes it's a con job in which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So the legitimacy of it is gone. Now, what we're beginning to see, however, is the possibility of emergence of this kind of ethno-nationalist protectionism, autarky, which is a different model of the economy. And that doesn't sit very well with the neoliberal ideals which were promoted earlier. So we could be headed into something which is much less pleasant even than neoliberalism, which is the division of the world into warring and protectionist factions who are fighting each other over trade and all the rest of it. And I think that the roots of that are also, I think, buried in two propositions which are very strong politically right now. The argument of somebody like Bannon is that we need to protect the working people of America from competition in the job market by limiting immigration. So we've got an anti-immigrant side to this, which is really very, very strong, and which the sort of cosmopolitan side of the economists think is disastrous. But that's the first argument. I mean, that's got a lot of purchase right now amongst populations who've been hurt in the labor market. So instead of blaming capital, you blame the immigrants. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to say, well, we can also protect that population and get support from that population by, you know, putting up tariff barriers and saying, blaming the Chinese and Chinese competition and all the rest of it. So in effect, you've got a right-wing kind of politics which is gathering a great deal of support amongst working people who've been left behind by being anti-immigrant and anti-offshoring of jobs. Now, the fact is that actually the biggest problem of jobs is not offshoring, it's technological change. About 60 or 70% of the unemployment which occurred after, you know, during the from the 1980s onwards, much of the unemployment was due to technological change. Only about, you know, 15, maybe 20 or 30% of it was due to offshoring. To China and the likes. But the right wing now has a politics. And if you look at what's happening, that politics is not only going on in the United States, you also find it going on in Hungary, you'll find it going on in India, you'll find it going on to some degree in Russia. So you're beginning to get this kind of ethno-nationalist, authoritarian kind of politics, which is beginning to break the capitalist world up into warring factions. And we know what happened with that sort of thing in the 1930s. So this is something that I think we should all be very concerned about. It is no answer to the capital dilemma. It is an answer to the neoliberal answer, and to the degree that ethno-nationalism will conquer neoliberalism, I think we'll be in for an even uglier kind of world than the one we've already been in.
These contradictions that you're describing are incredibly powerful ones within the governing conservative coalition in the U.S., and they're quite clearly manifested right now, but I think it's a mistake when people see them as brand new. I think they've been latent for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah. For instance, the anti-immigrant fervor, I was reminded of that because in Britain back at the end of the 1960s, there was this speech by Enoch Powell that talked about rivers of blood if we continue to this immigration policy. So the anti-immigrant fervor has been around for a long time, but I think that it managed during the 1980s and 1990s to sort of be kept under wraps because there was enough dynamism in the global capitalist economy for people to say, no, look, this open foreign open trade and a free trade regime, open, not open borders, but you know, reasonably benign immigration policies. This is all working for us, and it was in the 1990s, but since the 1990s it's gone very much in the other direction, and I think that we're now seeing the ascendancy of that of that kind of politics.
You just mentioned the huge power of automation in terms of rendering jobs that humans once did into ones that machines do. And there's a lot of debate over that on the left. What does Marx say about automation? And what do you make of this larger automation debate on the left? Is the end of work, as some say, really, really near? Or are such predictions more a sort of technology fetishism, given the mass proletarianization of huge swaths of the globe in recent decades?
Well, look, you know, I came to the United States in 1969, and I went to the city of Baltimore, and there was a huge iron and steel works in Baltimore that employed around 37,000 people. By the time I get to the 1990, the steelworks is still producing the same amount of steel, but it's now employing about 5,000 people. And now, of course, the steelworks is pretty much entirely gone. The point about this is that in the manufacturing sector, in industry, automation and the like actually drove out jobs wholesale all over the place very, very fast. And the left spent a lot of time trying to defend those jobs and kind of afford a rearguard action against automation and saying loss of jobs is horrible. I think that was a wrong strategy, and it was wrong for a couple of reasons. One was the automation was coming anyway, and you were going to lose. Secondly, I don't see why on the left we should be absolutely, you know, opposed to automation. I think it's a good idea. And now we're about to see the same thing going on in the service sector with artificial intelligence. And I think the left is in danger of running again, you know, against artificial intelligence. I think that Marx's position, insofar as he had one about this sort of thing, would be that we should make use of as much of this artificial intelligence and automation and so on as we possibly can, but that we should do it in such a way as that we would lighten the load of labor. And one of the big questions Marx asks in Capital Volume 1 is, John Stuart Mill wrote a piece where he kind of said, you know, we've got all these new technologies, but it seems that labor is not benefiting from it. Why not? And Marx says, well, of course labor's not benefited from it, because the purpose of this, you know, these technological changes is not to lighten the load of labor, but it's to improve the productivity of labor so that you produce more capital. And that until that's stopped, then we're going to find that artificial intelligence and automation and so on are going to be used in a way which is antagonistic to the well-being of the workforce. What we have to do is to turn that around. So the left should be working on a politics in which we say, look, we welcome artificial intelligence. We welcome robotization and automation. We welcome these things. But one of the things this should do is to give us much more free time. And one of the big things that Marx actually does suggest is that free time is probably one of the most emancipatory things we can have. And he has a nice little phrase. He said, the realm of freedom begins when the realm of necessity is left behind. And imagine a world in which necessities could be taken care of, maybe with 1 or 2 days a week working, and the rest of the time is free time. And then we could do what we like. Now, the interesting thing here is we've got all of these labor-saving innovations, and it's not only in the labor process, it's also in the household. We've got all of these time-saving devices in the household. But if you ask people, do you have more free time than you once had? The answer is, no, I have less free time. And actually, if you say, look, we've got to organize all of this so that we actually have as much free time as possible where we could do what on earth we like, so that, you know, if it's Wednesday at 5 o'clock, you can go do whatever you want. And this is the kind of imagination of a society that Marx has in mind, then kind of says, we use these things. And, you know, and I have a couple of people sitting around here, and they're smiling and laughing about this and thinking, what a great idea this is. And it's an obvious idea. You know, it's an obvious idea. And Marx is kind of saying, what's stopping us? Well, what's stopping us is because all of this stuff is being actually utilized, what, to actually prop up profits of Google and Amazon and everything else, and that is the problem. And until we deal with the social relations and the class relations behind all of this, we're not going to be able to use all of these fantastic devices and fantastic opportunities in ways which are actually the benefit of everybody.
I'm Aziz Rana, and you're listening to The Dig, a great place for analysis about where we are, how we got here, and what can be done. It's my favorite podcast, and you can support it at patreon.com.
This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by the Socialism 2018 Conference. If you like this podcast and want to connect with other radicals in real life, you should come this summer. The Socialism Conference is 4 days of political education, debate, and camaraderie. It takes place July 5th through 8th in Chicago and features activists, authors, and people just like you from across the country and around the world. Featured speakers include Boots Riley, Dave Zirin, Sarah Jaffe, Anand Gopal, Amy Goodman, and many more. The conference is packed with talks on everything from eco-socialism and climate change to black athletes in revolt to debates around topics like gun violence, resisting the police, socialists and elections, and the fight for universal health care. There will also be discussion about the movements of today, like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. And Socialism 2018 will feature leaders of the teachers' strikes that have swept through the so-called red states this spring. Teachers from West Virginia to Puerto Rico to Arizona will speak on two panels in Friday night's main plenary. Don't miss this opportunity to learn about the power of organized workers from rank-and-file leaders across the country. Socialism is co-sponsored by the Center for Economic Research and Social Change, ISO, Haymarket Books, Socialist Worker, and by Jacobin. And it will feature talks with Jacobin contributors on lessons from the current Teachers' Rebellion, the movements of 1968, Bernie Sanders, the future of the socialist left, and more. The conference is also a great place to learn the basics of Marxism. To learn more about the conference and to register, visit socialismconference.org. That's socialismconference.org. What do you think of universal basic income schemes? Many in Silicon Valley certainly seem to think that automation is going to pose a problem for them in terms of, I think, both consumer demand and political unrest.
But just think what kind of future they're suggesting in Silicon Valley. What they want is they want a universal basic income so people have enough money to sort of pay for Netflix so they can sit on a couch and binge watch on Netflix all day long and that's it. I mean, what kind of world is that? Talk about a dystopia. I mean, yeah, the progressive, so-called progressive folk in Silicon Valley want a universal basic income. And this fits also with some of the people on the left who also are talking about universal basic income. I actually think that's not the issue. I mean, the issue is, to me, universal basic income is one thing. The big problem is, Silicon Valley and those people who are kind of, sort of monopolizing means of communication and means of entertainment and all the rest of it. So I really think there's the problem doesn't lie there. And universal basic income at some point, something like that might be on the agenda. But I don't put it at the top of my political priorities as somehow or other this is the thing that's really going to save us all. In fact, I think there are many aspects of it that have highly negative possibilities, as the Silicon Valley model of it suggests.
I want to ask you about what's arguably the ultimate contradiction of capitalism, which is climate change and global warming. And I wonder if you think that climate change highlights clear limits to the permanent expansion required by capitalism, or whether it will be possible that capitalism might be able to weather the climate crisis intact, to everyone else's detriment, of course.
Yeah, that's what worries me. I mean, I think actually capital could weather the climate change crisis. I mean, in fact, when you look at some of the costs which are associated with the sort of climate disasters that are occurring, then, of course, capital can turn this into what we call what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism. You get a disaster, well, you have to rebuild. That gives lots of possible opportunities for capital to recuperate profitably from climate disasters. So my problem here is that capital could in fact weather climate change disasters and do it in a way which will be profitable to itself, but would be deleterious to the rest of us, as we have to deal with the kinds of issues that are posed. And it's not just simply climate change. It would be things like species extinction, quantity of plastic circulating in the oceans and habitat degeneration and all the rest of it. So I think that, from the standpoint of humanity or human beings, I think that we will not come out of this very well at all. And in fact, it will come out as a pretty miserable thing. But the capital is different. See, capital can come out of these things, and as long as it's profitable, they'll do it.
On that bleak note, I think it's a good time to shift gears and talk about resistance. you write that production and consumption are both core facets of capitalism, and that, quote, social and political struggles against the power of capital within the totality of capital circulation take different forms and call for different kinds of strategic alliances if they are to succeed. I want to ask you to explain what you mean here, and how we should think about the relationship between, say, labor struggles on the one hand and struggles against the state, against mass incarceration, against landlord evictions or predatory lending on the other.
One of the virtues, I think, of looking at capital as a totality and thinking of all of the aspects of the capital circulation process is that you start to identify different arenas of struggle. For example, we've just talked about one, which is the environmental question. Marx talks about the metabolic relation to nature and some of the things that can really go wrong in terms of that metabolic relation. And therefore, struggles over the relation to nature become politically very significant. Now, what we see in the world right now is a lot of people who are concerned about the environmental issue will say, well, we can deal with this without actually having to confront capital accumulation. And so there is a wing even of capitalists who say, well, environmental technologies are coming on board, renewable energy is becoming more feasible. So that we can actually solve the problems without actually dealing with capital. Now, I object to that because I think there are limited possibilities of doing that. I think that actually at a certain point we're going to have to deal with this dynamic of capital accumulation, which is about 3% growth forever, as a clear environmental issue. In other words, I don't think there's going to be a solution to the environmental issue without actually confronting capital accumulation and that dynamic. So just as on that metabolic relation to nature, I think there's something very, very important. Now, there are other aspects too. Capital has long been about the production of new wants, needs, and desires, and it's been about the production of consumerism. And I think one of the things that I just come back from China, I noticed in just the 3 or 4 years I've been going to China, the immense increase in consumerism in China. And this is what the World Bank and IMF was advising the Chinese to do, 20, 15 years ago, saying, you've got to cultivate your internal market because you're saving too much and you're not consuming enough. And so now the Chinese have obliged by beginning to set up a real consumer society and But that means that people's wants, needs, and desires are being transformed so that, say, 20 years ago in China, your want, need, and desire would be you needed a bicycle. Now you need an automobile. So the production of new wants, needs, and desires is something that is very much in the field of capitalist endeavor. And there are various ways in which that is done. I mean, obviously, the madmen of advertising have their role to play. But actually, even more important, I think, is the invention of whole new lifestyles. For instance, one of the things I've often pointed out is that one of the ways in which capital got out of its dilemmas in 1945 in the United States was through the suburbanization of the United States, which is the creation of a whole new lifestyle. And in fact, what we find is lifestyle creation is not a choice. I mean, we all have cell phones around this table. I go everywhere, everybody has a cell phone. This is not a sort of choice that I decided it was a good idea to have a cell phone. I had to have a cell phone. And so there's a whole lifestyle, which is now, and it's really fantastic going down the street. Everybody's not looking about what's going on around them. They've got their eyes on their cell phones. So this is the creation of a lifestyle. And that lifestyle is not something that I can individually choose to be in or out. I mean, you just don't have any choice. I have to have a cell phone, even though I don't know how the damn thing works and I have all kinds of problems with it. And I can't turn it off when I'm going to a concert and say, but, you know, all those sorts of things. But I think The point here is that it's not as if that somehow or other back in time whenever somebody was desiring and wanting and needing a cell phone. It came into being for a very particular kind of reason, and capital found a way of organizing a lifestyle around it, and so now we're locked into that lifestyle, and that's it. I mean, and I jokingly refer back to the suburbanization process, you know. Well, what do you need in the suburbs? You need a lawnmower. If you were smart in 1945, you would have gone into the production of lawnmowers because everybody's going to have a lawnmower on Sundays to go out there and go chunk around and cut their grass. So the point here is did people have a choice of their lifestyle, and in what sense do we have now? There are revolts against, it seems to me, certain things that are happening. We're getting what I would call mass alienation around some of the lifestyle things that are emerging, and people sort of beginning to say, look, we want to do something different. And I find little communities all around the place in urban areas and actually in rural areas too, where people are trying to actually set up a different alternative lifestyle, which is not based on some of these particular features, and is attempting to create an alternative kind of set of social relations. The ones that interest me most are those which actually use the new technologies, like cell phones and internet and all this kind of stuff, to actually create an alternative lifestyle, which is different kinds of forms of social relations than those which are characteristic of the corporation and which are characteristic of hierarchical structures of power that we encounter in our daily lives. So my point here is I can go around that whole arena of what capital accumulation is about and sort of pick on something like the production of new wants, needs, and desires, and talk about the struggles that go on around lifestyle choices and the like and what those struggles are about. Now, to struggle over a lifestyle is rather different than struggling over wages or conditions of labor in a factory. And there is, however, from the standpoint of the totality I'm talking about, there is a relationship between these different struggles. And one of the things that I'd be very interested to do is to sort of start to get people to see how struggles over the environment, struggles over the production of new wants, needs, and desires, and consumerism are related to the forms of production which are organizing, how conditions in the housing market are related. So you try to put all of these things together and start to get a picture of the totality of what a capitalist society is about and the different kinds of dissatisfactions and alienations that exist in different components of this whole kind of process of circulation of capital, which Marx identifies.
It seems to me that suburbanization is a really good case in terms of elucidating the ways that struggles around production and consumption can be linked, because the processes of dispossession and exploitation are linked, going back to the period after World War II, when you have massive suburbanization in the U.S. It happens in an incredibly uneven way, thanks to the way that racism works in American capitalism. You have housing segregation, you have job market segmentation, and within that segmented job market, you have basically whites-only building trades workers receiving the economic benefit of building those houses. How do you see struggles, especially given the current rise of ethno-nationalism and the long-standing problem for decades of mass incarceration in the U.S., the relationship between struggles against racism and these struggles over production and consumption that we've discussed?
Well, I mean, obviously, depending upon where you are in the world, these questions are foundational and fundamental. And obviously, here in the United States, this is a very, very, very big issue. You don't hit the same problem if you sort of looking at what's happening in China. But here, the forms that social relations take are always cut across by questions of gender, race, religion, and ethnicity, and the like. Now, I'm not going to argue, as some people do, that capital creates all of those problems. I think those problems are there and have been there for a very, very long time. But one of the things that capital does is to make use of those problems. I mean, the way the housing market was manipulated in this country during the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and then right through to today has been racialized from the very get-go. And therefore, you cannot deal with the question of the production of lifestyle or the production of one's needs and desires without actually then encompassing the whole kind of question of what happens in racialized housing markets and how the race question then gets utilized in various ways. For instance, when I first moved to live in Baltimore, I did a lot of studies, and one of the things that was going on was blockbusting, which was the use by the real estate industry of racial disparities in order to sort of force white flight and capitalize on high turnover in the housing market as a way of gaining a great deal of economic advantage. So these issues are there, and I think that the gender questions which arise around questions of social reproduction are also paramount in a capitalist society, and they're paramount no matter where you are, and so this is these issues are embedded in relationship to what the dynamics of capital accumulation are about. Now, when I'm talking about this, I often get into trouble because it makes it seem as if somehow or other capital accumulation is more important than these other aspects. The answer is to that is that no, that's not the case. But I think that one of the things that anti-racist struggles have to deal with is the way in which the dynamics of capital accumulation interfere with anti-racist politics and what that, you know, exactly what the relationship is between this accumulation process and the perpetuation of racial distinctions and racial markers, and actually in some instances even the creation of new forms of distinctions in say housing markets and the like. So to me, there is a very much broader question of what's happening in particular societies as a whole. Here in the United States, we have a whole set of these kinds of questions which are paramount. Again, can they be handled without at some point or other dealing with the way in which capital accumulation and the capital dynamic is actually fostering and confusing and perpetuating some of these distinctions? And I think the answer to that for me is no. I don't think that's possible. And in exactly the same way that not every anti-racist is anti-capitalist, at a certain point, I think anti-racists have to be also anti-capitalist if you're going to get to the real root of a lot of the problems.
Which is precisely what a lengthy interview I did with Barbara and Karen Fields was about in great part. You're well known, obviously, for your scholarly work, but you're perhaps even better known as a teacher of Marx. Your lectures on Capital have been viewed on YouTube a huge number of times. And I want to close by asking why you think it's important for leftists outside of the academy to engage with Marx's work and engage with it beyond the Communist Manifesto. And why do you think so many, as all of the people who are watching your videos show, clearly feel that it is so important that they do so?
When you're involved in political action and activism, you usually got some very specific target that you're involved with. You know, let's say lead paint poisoning in the inner city or something of that kind, and you're organizing around what to do about the fact that, 10 or 20% of the kids in the inner city of Baltimore suffer from lead paint poisoning or something of that kind, and you're involved in a legal battle, and you're involved in fighting with landlord lobbies and with all kinds of opponents. So most people I know who are involved in activist forms of that kind are so consumed with the details of what it is they're doing and how they're doing it and the struggles that they're involved in that they very often forget where they are in the overall picture of the struggles in general going on in a city, let alone going on in the world. Yet at the same time, it very often you find that people need sustenance from outside. That lead paint thing is kind of much easier to handle if you've got all of the people who are involved in, say, discrimination in the educational system, who see that having kids in schools and those kids have some problems with lead paint poisoning. You know, in other words, you start to build alliances. And the more alliances you can build, the more powerful you actually find your movement could be. And one of the things that I would try to do is not to lecture people on what they should think or anything like that, but to try to create a framework of thinking so that people can more easily see where they are in the whole totality of complicated relationships that make up contemporary society, and can start to think about asking people in alliances around the particular issues they're concerned with, and at the same time mobilize their own powers in terms of their own particular constituency to help other people in their alliances. So I'm into building alliances. And in order to build alliances, I think you have to have some sort of picture of the totality of what a capitalist society is about. And to the degree that you can get some of that from studying a bit of Marx and getting some presentations on Marx of the sort that I tried to lay out on the website, to that degree, I think that it's helpful to have this background so that you know where you are in the totality of struggles going on around you. And to me, that is just one of the things that I would want to do. And as you mentioned, the website with its lectures on Marx and on other issues has been an extremely popular website. And what's interesting about it is that I find people have used it in China, people have used it in Africa. I mean, it's all over the world. I mean, I'm surprised and shocked actually when I go around and I find that actually people are using it in Moscow. And you kind of go, well, you know, obviously there's a need out there for this sort of way of thinking. And I think that the more of us who can do some more work on the from the educational standpoint, the better it will be.
David Harvey, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. It's been great to talk with you.
David Harvey is a professor of anthropology at the City University of New York Graduate School and the author of Marx, Capital, and the Madness of Economic Reason from Oxford University Press. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said after thanking David Harvey for paying such close attention, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We're posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please do find us wherever you get podcasts, and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, please leave us a nice review there. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. What also does that is you telling your friends, family, total strangers about the show. All propaganda on our behalf is very much appreciated. And last but by no means least, please do find us at patreon.com/thedig and make a monthly contribution to keep this thing going. Even a few bucks is a big help.